Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, it's Stephen. On this week's New Statesman podcast, we discuss our never-ending lockdown, how devolution is responding to the crisis, and you ask us, how would this have all played out differently if Theresa May was still Prime Minister? So, I mean, I was about to say by the time you listen to this, it actually isn't true for any of our listeners, unless you're catching up on this very late. But notionally, it is not yet certain that the lockdown will continue, although, of course, I think anyone who's capable of reading the government's website or indeed paying attention to what the First Minister of Wales says, or the Health Secretary of Wales, or indeed any of the devolved governments, the extension's going to continue past the end of the Easter weekend. And I just thought it was an interesting kind of a useful moment for us to kind of stop and talk about, you know, politics and how it's sort of going in the age of social distancing.
Well, it's been a bit of a strange week, hasn't it, in terms of politics, because we've been not only been in the sort of confected social distancing limbo, which, like you say, of course, is going to be reviewed and then continued. But also we've been in the limbo of having the Prime Minister remaining in hospital as well, which means that the number of or the extent of questions that, you know, journalists can ask at those press conferences, etc., sort of are limited in terms of that, because, you know, for your reader's sake or whoever's sake, you have to ask the sort of obligatory, what can Dom Raab do in this period as the de facto deputy? And what about this scenario? Would you be able to carry on the Brexit negotiation talks without Boris Johnson, etc.? So it's sort of turned into a bit of a week of hypotheticals rather than reality. And like you mentioned, I mean, with the social distancing rules, Mark Drakeford, and we had a good question about devolved governments in the live podcast earlier this week. And again, he's sort of shown that he's ahead in terms of both common sense, but also in terms of communications, because he's being frank with people from the off rather than sort of creating this false suspense or the false sort of deadlines. And actually, from covering this whole thing, I don't know if you've found this, but the fact that most of the powers of the coronavirus act, like you wrote in your morning call email, Stephen, are devolved, it sort of highlighted how ahead the devolved, at least Wales and Scotland, have been ahead of Westminster. So a good example of that is the way that Mark Drakeford did invite the opposition parties to be in his core COVID group before there was any sort of public recognition of working with other parties in Westminster, for example.
I think, you know, when the inevitable inquiries, and I hope it is inquiries plural, partly because I think there's a lot of different levels of things going on, is then I feel that the one of the things that they have been a lot better at is A, kind of bringing in the other parties, and B, kind of just communicating what is going to happen. Although I think the open question is, to what extent is this a fault of us in the media, and what extent is this a fault of us in the government? Because it is obvious, if you look at what the objective of a lockdown is, which is to reduce the rate of transmissibility to below one, and then that flattens the curve. And then after, at the end of that, you can kind of see whether or not it's working, whether or not you can extend it. Now, we can't say for certain when that will be, but we can say for certain that it will not be this week. I think although all of the governments have got different things wrong, I think then specifically the government in London has been very poor at communication. And I think that that's been made more acute because now that the Prime Minister is sick, they're very aware that the press conferences are not working as they would like them to, and then they are aware that their communication needs to improve. But of course, even if they're aware of something and something's been signed off, there's a strong feeling that it's one thing for Boris Johnson to go, no, we're changing this, and quite another for Dominic Raab to go, no, we're changing it, even if he is actually just literally pulling off a completed folder down from the, you know, the kind of from the handover note, as it were.
And in either case, as you've written, Stephen, there's not going to be any change. I think it's partly a consequence of print media, right? In that you need a new line every day. You can't have the same splash as the day before, can you?
Yeah. The person who I think has actually really was very fortunate this week was Rishi Sunak, right, who announced a package to support charities, $750 million, which I know is obviously an unimaginable sum of money to, well, if it's not an unimaginable sum of money to everyone listening to this podcast, please send me some. But it's an unimaginable sum to, you know, a household, but is peanuts in terms of government spending, but also is peanuts in terms of the $4 billion shortfall this quarter that charities will face. And he announced it. And I know there was some nervousness in the Treasury and they were concerned that they were going to have to answer difficult questions, not least the thing that they had identified was that they thought they might have a political problem that they have consciously chosen not to do anything for private schools, which think that they are going to struggle because they are nominally charities, so they can't access all of the rent support, et cetera, et cetera. But there was not a single question about this announcement. And it was all, as you say, Patrick, this kind of slight weirdness, just like, when, what will happen with this review? What if aliens invade? Can Dominic Raab, can he lead First Contact? And it's this slight weirdness where I think it, A, means that the government gets off the hook a bit, but also does confuse people unnecessarily.
My favourite was, does Dominic Raab have the power to, and they said Dominic Grieve then, he definitely doesn't have the power to hire and fire ministers, but does Dominic Raab have the power to hire and fire ministers? It's like, what in what universe is that someone going to be planning a sweeping reshuffle at this point? Or indeed, why would anybody resign at this point?
Yeah, it's just, it is one of those things where, like, in the event of war, it's just like, okay, so which socially distancing army from another country do we envisage?
At the point when even the so-called Islamic State has stood down its people because of COVID and is doing social distancing itself, you know, I'm not ruling out the chance of anything bad happening, but it's sort of, I don't really understand why that's at the top of anybody's agenda right now.
Yeah. I do also love the idea that Boris Johnson, you know, comes back, you know, in 18 days, you know, like, you know, he's recovered and he's just like, oh, Dom, have you done anything? Where's Liz Truss gone? And Dom just trying to style it out, just like, it's the same cabinet it was, mate. It happens sometimes. I felt a bit woozy after, you know, I had a big flu. But yeah, it's just the whole hypothetical is just visibly insane. Anoush, on the subject of other things that the government has sort of tried but has not yet fully cleaned up, you did a sort of investigation this week into the world of second homers. These are the people who have fled London to, you know, shack up in the Cotswolds or something to avoid infection. What's going on with that?
Yeah, well, I thought it was an interesting subject, mainly the hook being what happened in Scotland with their chief medical officer, who was found going to her second home 2 weekends in a row in Fife, when she lives in Edinburgh. And actually looking into it, we found so many more different stories. Apparently, this is still happening a lot. People are still driving from cities to their second homes in more rural areas, and because now they know that it's the wrong thing to do, whereas maybe at the beginning when people said unnecessary travel, you know, try and avoid it, it might have been ambiguous. You might have been able to argue that you weren't sure whether you're allowed. Now people know that they're not allowed. They're going in the dead of night. So I was speaking to a couple of MPs about this who represent Dorset and Devon constituencies, and they were saying, we literally, you know, the roads are empty in the day and then it gets to 11 p.m. and there's traffic jams of people coming and sort of pretend, and then the next morning sort of pretending that they've been there all along but self-isolating in their second home. So there were some quite amusing stories, but of course it's not that funny, because as the data that we collated shows, most of the second home hotspots in England have had their health budgets cut significantly in the last 3 years, over 10%, lots of them. And so locals are really worried because they've got fewer hospital beds. They've often had hospital closures, or at least closures of A&E departments and vital services in their hospitals, and moved to the big hospitals in the bigger cities. So they've got a longer way to travel for their healthcare. But also they've found that their pharmacies are running out of the medication that they need, because there's so many more people now coming asking for medicine, but also having their sort of repeat prescriptions fulfilled in a different area. And that's sort of putting a bureaucratic burden on pharmacies as well, which are often the linchpin of healthcare in rural areas and small towns and villages. So some of the stuff that we found was really shocking. And what surprises me is that there's so little focus on that, as opposed to the focus on the number of Londoners who had the audacity to go to parks last weekend. It's sort of the flip side, isn't it? Okay, maybe some of them weren't obeying the laws to the letter in London, but lots of them will be living in flats without gardens or terraces or balconies. And then on the flip side, you have people who have a second property who are recklessly going and moving in. And I don't feel, apart from what happened in Scotland, which was a very high profile case, I don't feel there's been as much sort of focus on that, which again, it just highlights another one of the inequalities that's been exposed by this crisis.
Yeah, I think because, yeah, as you say, like a teeny tiny minority of people in parks and cities are breaking the rules, whereas 100% of people who have moved to their second home are breaking the guidelines. Right? But I think I was going to say it's a reflection of people in the media, except the thing that is really blowing my mind about the fact that this will happen this weekend, right, is, yeah, every weekend a large chunk of the media takes to Twitter to advocate that we all be locked in our flats, is that it's being generated by people who must know it's untrue, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, someone said, I can't remember who it was, but someone tweeted, you know, if you're going to shame people for being in parks over the Easter weekend, you also have to attach a floor plan of your home as well.
Yeah, because I think it is one of those things. And I think obviously there are downsides to this, but one of the things I'm finding maddening at the moment actually is that for all, you know, obviously we have many criticisms of the government's approach and we've discussed them already this week, but one of the things that the government is doing well is actually is providing quite a lot of data, and the death stats are being presented in this way. And if we covered an election like some outlets are covering the death stats, it would be like someone's like, oh, the exit poll says it's a hung parliament, but Labour have just won Islington North with 75% of the vote, so maybe the Tories will only have 10 MPs when this is over. Oh no, Surrey Heath has declared, maybe like Labour will be reduced to 15% of the vote. It's like, guys, this is not a helpful way of reporting a single day's figures. Just report the number, explain what the graph means. And it's particularly crazy when you have like journalists tweeting like, this shows it's flattening, while sharing a government graph that very much does not show flattening. And yeah, it's the same with like the selfish Londoners narratives. And I feel like every day they do a chart going, here's our chart showing that the vast majority of people are following the rules, and we need you to keep doing so. And then like someone's like, but if people keep violating the rules, you might have to just like, most people aren't violating. Like, I'm also deeply concerned that if I do get locked in my flat, it will actually end in me murdering another journalist, because I honestly do feel if I end up shut in without being able to go out to get some sunshine for a walk for 30 minutes, because a bunch of other people have decided then a good way to get clicks is to like do long lens photos of parks, I'm really concerned that bad things will happen.
You speak as if that sentiment about wanting to kill other journalists is a new thing, Stephen. but the interesting thing for me, actually, to pick up something you said about covering death figures like their polling, is the actual polling that's been done, especially the Welsh Political Barometer poll, given that, you know, to pick up what we said at the very start of this segment about Wales and how differently the government have handled it there, or indeed the differences in their communication strategy. The Welsh Political Barometer poll dropped today, had the Tories north of 40% of the vote, would be the largest party in the Assembly and would also finish way in front of Labour in a Westminster election. I remember my first reaction was like, oh my God, they've lost Torvine. God, this is nuts. And I tweeted something to that effect. I was like, God, poor Nick Thomas Simmons. And then you pause for 5 seconds and think, hang on, what use is a poll taken in the middle of a pandemic to anybody at this point? But I think actually you raise an interesting point on Twitter, Stephen, that it tells us that as much as there is a difference in Wales in terms of the response to this, people aren't necessarily rallying around their own, that's not the flag they're rallying around.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to belittle particularly things. I know some of the people who listen to this are Labour MPs who would lose their seats and everything. I don't want to belittle the scariness of that poll from a Labour perspective. But one, like ultimately, we're not going to have an election during lockdown, and predicting the politics of the world after lockdown is just like, well, you know, really, what's the point? But the party who I think that is a genuinely worrying poll for is Plaid Cymru, right? Because their whole political argument, right? The success of the SNP is shown in the fact that there is a rallying towards their government, even among people who don't vote for the SNP, right? They have successfully created slash benefited from a pre-existing distinct Scottish polity. And I think they've done a bit of creating and a bit of benefiting from its pre-existent state. Whereas the fact that you still have a situation where, and okay, I think the difference between the two polls does show a good sized chunk of the Welsh polity does view itself as different. But I think it's fascinating that, you know, 20 years after devolution, a process in which Plaid Cymru did better in that first set of devolved elections than the SNP did, the kind of three Wales, so broadly a kind of a British Wales, which it sees itself as Welsh, but only in the same sense I see myself as a Londoner, right? It's an important but part of a wider national identity, a distinct Welsh Wales, and then a post-industrial American Wales. Not obviously not full of American, but a sort of post-industrial Wales. And I think what's striking about that is it shows that 20 years after devolution, Plaid Cymru have not successfully increased the size of Welsh Wales beyond a fairly limited coalition of Welsh language speakers and creatives, right? The type of people who in Wales do also vote for the Green Party, but would vote Green elsewhere.
And obviously then you had the period where Leanne Wood tried to merge Welsh Wales with left Wales, I guess, or post-New Labour Wales, and that didn't work either.
That's a problem which is not going to go away, right? Whereas I think the rallying around the incumbent government, whether you are a Scottish Conservative or an English member of the Labour Party or a Welsh member of the Labour Party, the rallying around the Conservative government in London or the Scottish government in Edinburgh it takes care of itself, right? We don't know what the it taking care of itself political period afterwards will look like.
Mm.
Whereas I think, yeah, the existential challenge of why are they rallying to that flag and not that flag, I don't think does go away.
So the interesting question for me, and this isn't necessarily on the COVID question, it's actually, I guess my question to you, Stephen, is why do you think that is? Because obviously in Scotland, Labour really, you know, hammed up the idea of a separate Scottish polity, right? You had the fighting 50 Scottish Labour MPs in 87, was it? And then you had a really, you know, the Scottish party was always devolutionist. And I guess, obviously, Welsh Labour came to that a bit later and there was sort of less consensus on it, but you still have, they've still been banging, they've still depended on, and you could argue some of the successes in recent years has depended on the idea of a separate Welsh political consciousness. So would you say they're just on different timelines, or are we comparing apples and oranges, or what?
So I think it's a combination of things. I think I think one of the things that the Welsh Labour Party has done very effectively is it has robbed Plaid Cymru of some of its distinctiveness through its continued assertion of its Welshness. But I also think, right, like, ultimately, Scotland has a separate legal system, It just does have clearer delineation. And also, crucially, its actual capital is also its economic capital for the whole of Scotland, right? Whereas in the 2015 general election, in the Welsh leaders' debate, the moment for me that really stood out was when Leanne Wood said, look, what good does it do for Wales to make it easier for people to travel in to Chester? And you could kind of feel the audience just being like, well, obviously, that is to our benefit because that is the economic capital for a large chunk of Wales. I think ultimately, like, you know, politics is downstream from culture, but it's also downstream from economics, right? And the fact that there are closer economic ties, yeah, you asked me, and I thought something, John Morris, who was Attorney General throughout Labour's time in opposition, served in the cabinets of Wilson, Callaghan and Blair as a result of that. And yeah, the sort of last lunch I had with a politician before lockdown, it turned out, was with him. And one of the things he kind of said to me, which has really stuck in my mind, is he said, you've got to remember I'm from a conquered nation. Yeah, he was saying it in a half joking way, but I do think that is the kind of crucial difference, right? That a union forged by a merger of crowns is going to leave two more distinct polities. A union forged by conquest and a prolonged period of, you know, prohibited language, et cetera, is always going to make it harder afterwards to assert itself separately. And I've always kind of believed that one of the weird advantages the SNP has is that it's much easier for Scottish political identity to be inclusive, precisely because it doesn't actually have the same foundational grievance as Welsh nationalism.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
And now's the time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
Thank you. So, Stephen, you had a question from a Morning Call subscriber.
Yep. And yes, and just to reiterate, there are multiple... Well, the best way to ask a question is via the Google form, which will be my pinned tweet by the time that this comes out. And it would be helpful if my Outlook hadn't just crashed. Imagine for a moment that this crisis was happening not in January, February, March of 2020, but in 2019, Theresa May, not quite at the absolute nadir of her powers, but close to it. Would things have been different, I guess? And how would they have been different?
I mean, what the hugest difference would have been that it was happening with the backdrop of Brexit not done, to use the popular phrase. So I suppose that would have been there have been a few questions this week about what's going to happen with Brexit. Is it going to be delayed, etc.? But, you know, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, could stand up and say at the press conference, well, you know, we have left the European Union. Theresa May wouldn't have been able to say that back then. So I think that probably would have been one of the bigger stories, which hasn't really dominated the narrative this time round. And I suppose, you know, depending on how bad things were, it would have been quite a good excuse to delay things or do things differently or negotiate differently. I suppose it could have helped her in a sense.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? The sort of facetious answer I have is that had this happened a year ago, every journalist would be in a re-education camp on the Isle of Man because Theresa May would have still be exercising her emergency powers. But I don't know, because her standing in April was so... I mean, we were sort of getting into the cross-party talks period now. The feeling inside the Tory party was so febrile at that point. I wonder whether... Does she survive? I mean, it's an interesting question. Or does the PLP assert itself? I mean, not that the PLP ever asserted itself or could assert itself. But at that point, did the PLP, you know, reach for the lever with the label Margaret Beckett on it and then say, come on, let's work something out. Let's have a COVID government. I don't know is the short answer. But I don't know, something in my gut tells me Theresa May... Something in my gut tells me that Theresa May doesn't come out of it well. But also, what was Theresa May for? What did Conservative MPs vote Theresa May in for, if not to steady the ship at a moment like that? I just wonder if in the heads of Tory MPs, the distrust towards Theresa May is that great over Brexit. She's not even a selling share at that point. She's a junk bond politically. I wonder whether at that point Tory MPs go, no, come on, you know, she's not the person to lead us through this. Or conversely, do they then get behind her because it's such a grave crisis?
My instinct, right, is what was the kind of peak of Theresa May's post-2017 power? Now, obviously, that is peak with the, you know, with the obvious caveat of the word post-2017. It was during the attack on the Skripals, right, which essentially allowed her to return to her kind of core Home Office crisis managed stuff. And I suspect that a similar dynamic would have played itself out. I agree with your half joke that Theresa May, I think, you know, her kind of securocrat leanings would have meant that we would have locked down faster. There's a very good Reuters piece about, you know, what the scientific advice said and, you know, how that ended up with where it. But I think there were lots of reasons why the United Kingdom, you know, why all of the devolved governments pursued a position that was supported by a minority of scientists around the world for, I mean, I was going to say for so long, for not that long in sort of relative terms, but for quite long in terms of the lifespan of the disease. I do think one of the reasons why isn't you had a Downing Street which was reluctant and still is a bit, right? That is one of the problems with the whole kind of, like one of the reasons why a large chunk of the media is going, could we be out in a week? Is because the government is reluctant to go, actually, bad news, guys, you're going to be living like this for an indefinite period. We can explain what the exit route is, but we can't be certain when the exit will actually arrive. I think then because May would have been much more inclined to go, well, they've locked down there, I'm going to lock down here because I am a pro-lockdown type politician. I suspect then the UK would have come into line sooner. rather than it being one of that minority of countries of which Sweden is now really the only country left standing, rather than being in that group for some time. The flip side, though, is that, so I guess I kind of agree with Anoush, and it would have strengthened her. Like, the thing that this has exposed, right, is that the model of Brexit that you would be able to do if you left the customs union, which I have written about, you know, not entirely unsympathetically, to make the economics work, is you basically go, well, we just won't have much of a British farming industry. And that allows you to strike a trade deal with the US, a trade deal with the EU, a trade deal with Japan, and you just become even more of a net importer of food. I don't think then that is going to be a sustainable political position now.
Yeah, after that, yeah.
Just to return to the Westminster politics, just very briefly, what do you think it would have meant for the politics of the Labour Party at that point, given that, as you said, April, the PLP is at odds over lots of things, the people who eventually split start to assert themselves over foreign policy, obviously Brexit is causing massive ructions at that point. Do you think it might galvanise the PLP at that point to do anything, or do you think they just harumph a little bit louder and from the comfort of their own constituency homes?
You can almost imagine it playing out in a similar way to the way that Brexit was playing out, in that there would be even more rancour and anger in the party at the fact that their leader wasn't a strong enough opposition leader, to meet the challenge of this generation's greatest crisis. There was so much language like that and so much feeling around that during Brexit, and this is sort of that times 100. So
yeah,
I imagine that it probably would have accelerated the splits.
I also think, like, one of the radicalizing factors in Labour politics, than in Labour parliamentary politics, and is kind of underrated, is WhatsApp. You had various support groups of people who couldn't stand it, who essentially all decided to leave. Now, that was partly about physical socializing, but it was also about social media socializing. But because basically, right, the choice before you, if you're a Corbyn skeptic in the Labour Party, is you either split or you convince. And Keir obviously successfully did the convincing part, and the Change people split. And I would argue did successfully change the politics of the European stuff. But you then had a kind of middle ground of people who basically were just like, I'm going to be loud and quite unpleasant in a way that doesn't actually advance my aims at all. And I think one of the things which fueled that was people who were angry about the political situation, WhatsApping each other and kind of amping each other up.
Mm.
And I suspect that one of the consequences of social distancing at that point is it would have just sort of driven that stuff further. The question is, would that have been the push, right? Because obviously, like, the biggest single political failing of Labour politics in that period was that group of Labour MPs who wanted Theresa May's Brexit to happen, didn't vote for it. Most of them did end up voting for Boris Johnson's Brexit deal, and then they lost their seat in the election. Now, the question I have is, would this event, and because there would have been this kind of like, okay, what's going to happen around Brexit? And I think that what's going to happen around Brexit would have definitely increased this sense of there's a deal on the table. It's take it or we indefinitely extend until we leave. I think that would have strengthened the hand of the Michael Gove argument, right, which was basically like, guys, just vote for the exit terms. We'll sign hundreds of trade agreements with the EU over the life of our time outside of it. We can fix things we don't like about this later on in trade talks. I think that group would have been strengthened. And I think if anything was going to push that kind of like Gareth Snell, Lisa Nandy group into actually voting for it, surely it would have been this moment of you have to decide right now. Because the problem that group never had is they never were really forced to decide. There was always a moment when they could say they could always be willing to vote for something.
Also, I mean, a really big watershed in terms of Labour's movement on the European question, as well as Change UK, with the European election results, after which Corbyn said for the first time, we now support a second referendum in any circumstances. Up until then, Labour's policy had been a second referendum to prevent a damaging Tory Brexit. At that point, their policy was just, we are the party of a second referendum. But given that the European elections would have been postponed, surely that significantly chills it. It doesn't escalate divisions in both parties in that way. It's not an existential defeat for the Conservative Party. There's no incentive for them to reach for the button marked Boris at that point, because Farage hasn't annihilated them at the polls. And ditto, Labour isn't or rather Lotto, aren't pushed into a second referendum position because they've paid no demonstrable electoral penalty. Sure, maybe the Lib Dems are still riding high in the polls, but does that give everyone a bit more time and space? And indeed, when in the form of a deal on the table and the urgency in terms of the pandemic to get the other big policy question off the table, does that just allows everyone to chill out and see the question anew?
I really wish, I wish that it had in this hypothetical universe, but just remembering what the atmosphere was like back then, I do feel like coronavirus would have just been an excuse for everyone to advance their different stances, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
yeah, exactly.
This has happened, let's not do Brexit for the Remainer or second referendum kind of contingent, or this has happened, how on earth can we accept this deal that would sign our powers away to the EU that are coping with the virus so badly, from the Eurosceptics, for example. And then for Theresa May and everyone who wanted the MPs to vote through the deal, this has happened, just vote through the deal that's on the table so that we can concentrate on this, which is far more pressing. You can imagine it sort of dividing everyone even more and sort of intensifying the gridlock.
Yeah, I mean, also, and also everyone was so exhausted, and that was one of the reasons why they were making such bad decisions. I think this is the thing, isn't it? I guess the answer is it would have been worse. But I do think, because they weren't that far away from a majority for Theresa May's deal, right? Like in the third meaningful vote, they'd already scared most of the Brexiteers over the line because of the fear that they'd lose Brexit. And the only thing they needed was for the Labour MPs who wanted to vote for a deal to, you know, vote for a deal. But I guess this is, and it comes back to Patrick's question about would the PLP have acted at some point, is what do we think the PLP's inaction was really about? Was it about two conflicting electoral pressures which they couldn't reconcile? Was it, as one Labour MP suggested to me, the reason why they think that they shouldn't do it is because the reason why they haven't done it is they know consciously that they shouldn't do it? Or was it that ultimately the thing that unifies basically all Labour MPs, both then and now, is why were you still a Labour MP at this point in 2019? Because your attachment to the Labour Party was very strong. And I think that for me is why I don't really buy the sort of Margaret Beckett unity government hypothetical. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, my colleague Anusha Kelly, and our political correspondent, Patrick Maguire. Alva Ray is enjoying the delights of a socially distancing holiday in her own flat, but we'll be back with us next week. Our music is Devil by the Devil. We're recorded and produced by Nick Hilton. If you're enjoying the New Statesman podcast, please do give us a favourable review on your pod provider of choice. And if you can, please do consider subscribing to the New Statesman.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.